Today is Thursday, April 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, not a cure, but a ray of hope amid the pandemic. Scientists say a drug shows promise as an effective treatment against the coronavirus.
The data shows that remdesivir has a clear-cut, significant, positive effect in diminishing the time to recover.
The last places on Earth without a single case of COVID-19. Also ahead, some musical artists are stepping up to help the class of 2020 graduate virtually. It's all on today's International Edition. Scientists have announced what they believe is the first effective treatment against the coronavirus, an experimental drug that can speed the recovery of COVID-19 patients. The top U.S. infectious disease official, Dr. Anthony Fauci, said Wednesday that a major study found that the experimental antiviral drug remdesivir was found to shorten the time it takes to recover by about 4 days on average, from 15 days to 11.
Although a 31% improvement doesn't seem like a knockout 100%, it is a very important proof of concept, because what it has proven is that a drug can block this virus.
Still, Fauci told reporters during a White House meeting Wednesday that the drug needs to be analyzed further and does not prevent someone from contracting the virus.
This has nothing to do with vaccines. This is treatment for people who are already infected. Vaccines is to prevent infection in those who are at risk.
The U.S. government says it's working to make the medication available to patients as quickly as possible. Meanwhile, President Trump says a lot of progress is being made toward developing a COVID-19 vaccine.
They do come up with vaccines. I mean, you look at what's happened as an example with Ebola, with AIDS, with others that have been so incredibly successfully, if not eradicated, certainly it's been incredible what some of, you know, with what these people that I'm dealing with right now, like Gilead today, with, you know, what they came up with as an example.
The administration is said to be organizing a project called Operation Warp Speed that aims to rush a coronavirus vaccine. But infectious disease specialists say the promise of a vaccine this year or within 12 to 18 months is promoting what could be false optimism. Joining us to talk about it is Dr. Arthur Kaplan, professor of bioethics at New York University Langone Medical Center. Thank you for being with us. So you're warning that there's no magic bullet for a quick vaccine to eradicate this virus from our lives. Can you explain?
Well, I think it would help us a great deal to have a vaccine. That's probably the most important breakthrough we could get. Are we going to have it this year? I'd be willing to bet a lot of money, no. And the reason I say that is there are so many steps that have to be taken before you could get really hundreds of millions of doses of vaccine out to either Americans or billions of the world. It is just silly to talk about doing it by the end of this year. People are getting the impression from the administration, even from some of our top scientists, like Dr. Fauci, that 12 months, 18 months is realistic to have a vaccine that would help us vaccinate our way out of this plague. Look, here's some steps. We've tried to find a vaccine for AIDS for about 30 years, and we haven't. So one problem is, just because everybody's working hard and would really like to do it and could even make some money from it, it doesn't mean we'll get it. We also don't have one for hepatitis C. We also don't have a very good one for flu. We have one that's about 40% effective, but it's not a great vaccine. So the first obstacle is just figuring out, are we going to do this more like polio? Are we going to be lucky and do it like we did with hepatitis A and measles, or are we going to be confounded? Second, even if you get a breakthrough, then you have to figure out, how effective is the vaccine? People think, oh, vaccine, it must be 100%. No vaccine is 100%. The best numbers I've ever seen in a vaccine, probably measles vaccination, is about 95%, but there's still 5% of people who, for whatever reason, don't respond to it. So you have a lot of vaccines that millions and millions of people don't respond to. And some of them also require not just getting getting vaccinated, but getting vaccinated every year, like the flu, or three shots, like the cervical cancer vaccine. So the reason I'm pointing this all out is when somebody says, well, we'll have a vaccine, I'm thinking, what if it's only 50% effective? Are we going to make it and distribute it and just say, well, that's better than nothing? Or what if it requires two shots or three shots? Could we really get that done effectively around the world? If you don't do it worldwide, you're just begging the virus to come back.
What if another country, like, say, Germany, comes up with a vaccine for COVID-19? What would that mean for the rest of the world, including the U.S.?
Vaccine manufacturing has been falling down for decades, so we only have five big companies, really, that make most of them. The question really is, if some country came up with a vaccine, would they say, okay, well, we'll give it to the place that needs it the most? Or would they say, nah, we don't care. We're going to keep it here in Germany and vaccinate everybody in Germany. So again, another problem with vaccines, I'm not sure they're going to go where they're needed the most.
Is there no way at this point to really predict whether we will have a vaccine, it will be able to be distributed, we will all be able to get it in any sort of time frame at this point?
One other factor in terms of when could we expect this, and that's cost. Tetanus vaccine is pretty cheap. I think it costs 10 cents and it's around the whole world and there are a few places that don't have enough of it, but it's pretty good. It's out there. HPV vaccine for cervical cancer, $300. Shingles vaccine, a very new one using new technology, given to older people, probably $500.
Wow.
If this vaccine turns out to be $500 per go, I think you can see what the other problem is. The rich might get it. The connected might get it. The rich countries might get it. But there's going to be an awful lot of people who aren't going to be able to afford a $500 vaccine.
There are a lot of variables that are still unknown is what I'm hearing.
And I'm going to say, even though the name of this vaccine project that was announced is Project Warp Speed, if you put a vaccine out there that is dangerous, that winds up having side effects that hurt people or even killed people, there's a lot of people who are leery of vaccines anyway, right?
Right.
You can't do that. You can go fast, but you still have to be safe. You have to make sure that you're not going to cause harm. And to me, the realistic timeframes are measured in many years, not months.
A new study of a drug, remdesivir, showing some promise.
What the drug has shown is that in about 30% of people who were getting better, they recovered more quickly. It doesn't say that it saved them or rescued them from dying. It just said once you turn the corner and begin a recovery, this drug seemed to help you recover more quickly. That's good. I'm not sure that's going to knock down the death rate. It will knock down the hospitalization rate. It'll make it easier for people with the disease to bear it because it'll be shorter. But it's an early promissory note, and I think you're going to see more drugs come along that do a little, but we can't go day after day saying, oh, today we got the magic bullet. I don't think viruses are going to get treated that way. That hasn't been the experience, again, with AIDS and HIV. The thing that ultimately worked out for AIDS was multiple drugs used together finally established some control. No single drug did it. And the data that he's got is early data. We'll have to see if it holds up in bigger numbers. Looking for a magic bullet or a overnight breakthrough.
Dr. Arthur Kaplan, professor of bioethics at New York University Langone Medical Center. The federal government's social distancing guidelines are due to expire today, and President Trump says he will not be extending them. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
They were issued 45 days ago.
They'll be fading out because now the governors are doing it.
With the guidance folded into recommendations given to state leaders like Louisiana's John Bel Edwards, who sat with him in the Oval Office.
It's sort of a seamless way to do it.
Edwards is under fire at home from Republicans for extending Louisiana's stay-at-home order through May 15th. The president's been eagerly touting some states reopening, even as the nation hits grim milestones. More than 58,000 Americans have now died from the virus, more than were killed in the Vietnam War. More than 1 million have tested positive, which the president says is good news in a way.
It's a tremendous amount, and the reason is because of testing, because other countries don't test. So if you don't test, you're not going to find cases.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
There will be a deeper review of the events surrounding the COVID-19 outbreak aboard the USS Theodore Roosevelt, including the removal of the ship's captain. U.S. officials also say Navy sailors who've been quarantined on Guam for days will begin moving back to the USS Theodore Roosevelt. International Edition's Steve Miller got an update with VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb.
Sailors are finally getting back on board. At the height of this last week, about 4,200 sailors were off of the ship. So that was only about 600 sailors, give or take, that were staying on this massive aircraft carrier to keep the main things going, the nuclear reactor, to protect some of the equipment, some of those fighter jets that are on board, things like that. But everybody else had moved off so they could clean the ship. Now, the Navy had expected to bring these sailors back on much sooner, but they kept finding out that this virus is a little bit different than they expected. They ended up having to test and then retest all of the sailors because some sailors would test negative, and then a few days later would test positive again. So they learned through this carrier that they actually need longer than 14 days. And they have carried this out not only with the Teddy Roosevelt of getting the two negatives, they've waited even longer in quarantines before putting sailors on other ships, like the USS carrier, the Nimitz. Those sailors waited 27 days in quarantine before they were placed on the ship, and the ship was underway in the Pacific starting earlier this week.
The Theodore Roosevelt came to Providence after it was revealed that its commanding officer, Captain Crozier, wrote a letter that was then leaked to the media, and he was subsequently removed from command. What is the latest?
Well, we have just learned, the Navy just issued this statement moments ago, that the Secretary of the Navy, the Acting Secretary of the Navy, James McPherson, has said that the preliminary inquiry into this event, that's not enough. He says he still has unanswered questions, and so he has asked for a deeper review. Now, Captain Crozier's future hangs on this review, and I have learned from some Navy officials that Admiral Gilday, the head of the Navy, the top naval officer in the Navy, had recommended the unprecedented move of reinstating Captain Crozier. It would be the first time that the captain of an aircraft carrier who was removed from the ship was reinstated. But I have also learned that Secretary of Defense Mark Esper heard the investigation, started reading it. The acting secretary of the Navy started reading it, and they said, look, this review isn't enough. If we're going to make a move that is this big, we need to make sure that everything is in place. And so we do not know how long this deeper review will last, but it could last several days, even several weeks.
Big meatpacking companies that have struggled to keep plants open during the coronavirus crisis say they're welcoming President Donald Trump's executive order requiring plants to stay open to protect the U.S. food supply. But it is creating a backlash with some employees, Democrats, and unions about whether workers can be kept safe. VOA's Carol Gunsberg talked to Cooper Carraway, president of the Sioux Falls AFL-CIO, which represents 36 labor unions, about the outbreak that forced the Smithfield plant to temporarily suspend operations at a pork processing facility in mid-April. She asks what guidance workers, 3,700 of which are immigrants, have been given in the president's return to work order.
Yeah, so we get a lot of guidance from the National AFL-CIO, and we offer guidance to our membership, particularly following CDC guidelines, best way to implement some workplace safety precautions where they work and things like that. And we also offer guidance to local businesses, particularly around staggered scheduling, making sure that folks are 6 feet apart and implementing social distancing and stuff like that, changing their capacity in the workplace when it comes to the number of people allowed in their business at one particular time. We offer, obviously, we encourage groups that are not Tier 1 essential functions to go ahead and close down and provide full pay and benefits to their workers while they are closed down.
South Dakota's governor has declined to impose a stay-at-home order. Do you have a position on that?
We do. We've been pushing the governor for some time to implement a stay-at-home order. We've been pushing her to issue a stay or moratorium on evictions and mortgage foreclosures. We've been asking her to institute a halt on utility shutoffs. because, you know, our priority is safety, and we want to make sure that working class people are in a position to where they can follow the CDC guidelines. So if the CDC guideline is that you need to wash your clothes when you come home and that you need to consistently be washing your hands, then you need to have running water, and you can't have running water if your utilities are getting shut off. We need to make sure that they're following the CDC guidelines when it comes to self-quarantining, if you've been in contact with folks who have been exposed, and things like that. But you cannot self-quarantine if you're being evicted or foreclosed upon. And so really all we want is the tools to be able to follow the guidance from the CDC. Unfortunately, when we've asked for these things from the governor, she's chose to engage us in this kind of odd Ayn Randian philosophical discussion, academic discussion on what it means to be a free man under capitalism or whatever she's trying to do. You know, she comes out and she says, well, you have the freedom to shelter in place right now. You have the freedom to self-quarantine in a hotel room. You have the freedom to go to work. You all can do these things right now. It's about personal responsibility. And it's unfortunate that she's attempting to engage us in these academic and intellectual discussions when all we're asking for is the tools to keep ourselves and our families safe.
When did the local representing Smithfield workers recognize potential risk?
So about 6 to 7 weeks ago, the workers at Smithfield kind of raised the alarm. You know, the Smithfield workforce is one of the most diverse workforces in the country. There's over 80 different languages spoken inside that plant, people from all over the world. So they were in a unique position to be able to identify the plant as a potential hotspot very soon, because they're getting calls and messages and reports from their families that are in Asia, that are in Africa, that are in Eastern Europe, and things like this, hearing about how the pandemic is affecting their home country. So they were able to very quickly identify the plant as a potential hotspot. They raised the alarm. They asked the plant to institute staggered scheduling, to institute temperature checks and secondary screening, to institute social distancing and things like this. But unfortunately, the management didn't take those calls seriously until dozens of workers had already tested positive. Now, the plant did end up instituting all of those recommendations, but by then over 80 folks had already tested positive and it was too late to stop the spread.
And what union represents the Smithfield workers?
The Smithfield workers are proudly represented by the United Food and Commercial Workers Local 304A.
Do you have any advice for workers elsewhere in other parts of the United States or globe who might face the risk of infection in the workplace?
The best advice I can give is that there's nothing special about the Smithfield plant in Sioux Falls. The Smithfield plant was built about a century ago at a time when a lot of our factories and plants were built.
Here are some of the other stories we're following at VOA News. About 24 migrants deported from the United States on a flight to Colombia last month have tested positive for the new coronavirus, to worries that U.S. deportations could be helping spread the virus. Satellite imagery showing recent movements of luxury boats often used by North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and his entourage near Wonsan provide further indications he's been at the coastal resort. That according to experts who are monitoring the reclusive regime. Speculation about Kim's health and location have erupted after his unprecedented absence from April 15th celebrations to mark the birthday of his late father. Despite infecting more than 3 million people around the world, there are still 34 countries and territories that have yet to report a single case of the novel coronavirus. They include Comoros, Lesotho, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and tiny far-flung island nations in the Pacific, such as Nauru, Kiribati, and the Solomon Islands. Stay with VOA for all the latest U.S. and world news. The director of the African Centers for Disease Control says African countries need to conduct 10 million COVID-19 tests in the next few months, but so far have only conducted 600,000. VOA's Jason Patinkin tells us that while Africa has relied on test kits from Germany and China, health officials say they're now looking for other suppliers.
Africa's top doctor warned Tuesday that the continent faces a major testing shortage in the fight against COVID-19.
One of the greatest challenges we have in our response strategy for this pandemic on the continent of Africa is testing. We are very low, with less than 600,000 tests on the continent, which I believe is too minimal for now.
Dr. John Nkengasong, director of the African Centers for Disease Control, said the hardest hit countries are still testing far short of what they need.
Algeria is testing about 105 tests per million. Morocco about 455 tests per million. Egypt about 560 tests per million. And South Africa about 2,000 tests per million. I think we need to ramp that up to scale.
Nkengasong spoke at a virtual panel organized by the Washington-based policy think tank, the Atlantic Council. The veteran virologist said that to ramp up testing, the African CDC and the African Union have launched a partnership to accelerate COVID-19 testing on the continent. He said their goal is to roll out 1 million more tests in Africa in the next 5 weeks and 10 million tests in the next 3 to 4 months. But that means getting millions more COVID-19 tests.
We've ordered 1 million tests from a company in Germany, which has been supplying us the tests since the beginning of this outbreak. And it's the same company that has been producing tests for WHO as well. So we have a common supplier there.
But with the whole world in need of tests, that company can't keep up with demand, Nkengasong said.
The second source of tests that the continent has received massive support is through the Jack Ma Foundation donation, which in the last 4 weeks or so, they were able to distribute to the continent 1 million tests. And today, another shipment of 500,000 tests will be coming from the Jack Ma Foundation in a bundle that will include extraction reagents, the test itself, and the swabs. So I think that is also going to be a huge relief for the continent.
Nkengasong said Africa's CDC is also looking for commercial manufacturers as a third source of test kits. He mentioned U.S. companies Cepheid, Abbott, and Roche, who already work with Africa's CDC to test for tuberculosis, HIV, and malaria.
The Africa CDC is in discussions with the leadership of CEPI to understand how we can provide us direct support, because the point of care test that has been developed by that company would be a game changer if large amounts were to be available for us to scale up the testing, especially in the remote areas, the more vulnerable areas like the slum cities and around the capital cities.
But Nkengasong warns that having enough test kits is just one step. He said tests must be targeted, noting that some African countries are testing hundreds of people, but only finding a handful of infections despite the virus spreading in the community.
You really have to find the cases as much as possible, isolate them, do the contact tracing, the basic things, so that we tilt the balance against the 3 million deaths that are projected on the continent.
For Africa, the race to test fast and test smart is on. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Washington.
The COVID-19 pandemic has forced Ghana to improve its healthcare system. This week, the government pledged to build dozens of new hospitals in the West African nation, and new technologies are also coming into play. The Silicon Valley, California company Zipline is using drones to carry samples from suspected coronavirus patients to labs in Ghana's big cities, to allow the government to more quickly monitor the spread of the COVID-19. Stacey Knott reports from Accra.
Ghana's president, Nana Akufo-Addo, in a televised address to the nation on Sunday night, said the virus had exposed the deficiencies of Ghana's healthcare system due to years of underinvestment and neglect. He pledged to make a major investment in Ghana's healthcare infrastructure and build 88 100-bed hospitals throughout the nation.
We shall make these investments in our healthcare system not because it is going to be easy, but because it is self-evidently necessary to serve the needs of 21st century Ghana.
Ghana has 1,617 confirmed cases of COVID-19 to date and 16 deaths. Akufo-Addo said the virus had also highlighted the crucial role of emergency services. He referred to Zipline, which has been in operation for a year and is playing an active role in fighting the virus. The Silicon Valley tech business is delivering COVID-19 test samples from rural areas of Ghana to the country's two testing centres in the capital Accra and Kumasi, the country's second largest city. The process begins when healthcare workers place orders for medicine or medical products to ZipLine's distribution centres. The deliveries are sent out by drones, which, within an average of 30 minutes, drop a box of medical products by parachute at a designated spot. Daniel Marfo, general manager of ZipLine in Ghana, said the company is also sending out personal protection equipment to rural health facilities when they have a suspected COVID-19 case, as well as transporting tests back to labs in the cities. Marfo said this saved time for rural health facilities and is more efficient than road transportation.
Immediately that they have a suspected case of COVID, they reach out to ZipLine using multimodal transportation. We are then able to reach out to them, pick up these samples from them to our distribution center. And from our distribution center, our drone then flies it off to the testing lab.
Cosmas Tebimaku, a disease control officer, has been using ZipLine's drones to deliver samples from COVID-19 patients in Ghana's Sichiri Central District. The district is mostly rural and many areas do not have good roads. He said drones bring samples to testing centres in about one-third the time it would take by car.
All samples, when taken, needs to get to the testing laboratory as soon as possible to maintain sample quality. So comparing the traditional method of sample transport, which is by road, and ZipLine's drone technology, you would realise transporting sample through ZipLine is more judicious in terms of time, cost, and risk.
Marku said he hopes ZipLine expands its drone service to transport other kinds of medical samples and should continue doing so once the pandemic is over. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra.
International Workers' Day, which is normally marked by demonstrations in cities around the world and calls for better working conditions. But this year, the lockdown in many countries means protesters will be forced to stay at home. And as Henry Ridgewell reports from London, the coronavirus pandemic is wreaking havoc on the global economy, which brings a whole new element to the conversation.
Hundreds lined up to receive emergency government aid in Brazil's Rio de Janeiro this week as the economic crisis destroys businesses and jobs. Job seeker Evanilson Ulysses says we don't even fear the coronavirus that kills, but hunger is very cruel. The UN's International Labour Organization warns that half of all workers worldwide, amounting to 1.5 billion people, are in danger of having their livelihoods destroyed by the coronavirus pandemic. That stark prediction comes on the eve of International Workers' Day, May 1st. Sharon Burrow, General Secretary of the International Trade Union Confederation, says this year we should be thankful for the workers who are putting their lives on the line.
Those courageous workers in health who go to work every day along with others in care settings and risk their health and safety and that of their families to save lives. But there are others who make themselves available in services, in transport, in our supermarkets.
Burrow says many of those key workers feel insecure in their jobs.
This virus has exposed the fragility of our world. When you consider that 60% of the global workforce work informally, no rights, no minimum wages, no social protection, no rule of law to deal with grievance, that's simply an economic risk as well as a social devastation that has to be undone.
May Day is usually marked by anti-capitalist protests. This year, with hundreds of countries in lockdown, demonstrations will likely be absent. Burrow says the focus should be on the world that will emerge after the pandemic.
We must rebuild a more equal world that guarantees democratic rights and freedoms, that allows for more equal development.
Before that can happen, millions of people face a struggle to get through the coming economic crisis. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Yeah, I'm going to take my horse to the old town road. I'm going to ride till I can't no more. I'm going to take my horse.
It is graduation season, but there will be no pomp and circumstance in the U.S. with students walking on stage to collect their hard-earned diplomas. But to offer an alternative, Lil Nas X and Miley Cyrus will be helping the class of 2020 graduate virtually. Lil Nas X will be one of the speakers at the Graduation 2020 event on Facebook on May 15th. Cyrus will sing her hit song, The Climb. Oprah Winfrey will be the main speaker with other speeches by Awkwafina, Jennifer Garner, and Simone Biles. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Bunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and be well. Okay.